You are listening to episode 167 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast, The Escape Velocity of Marketing Campaigns.
Episode 167 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is December the 6th, 2014. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my Christmas decorating brother, James Furlough.
Yeah, that's right. Merry Christmas. I've got stockings.
Yeah.
Right there. You can see all four stockings ready to go.
That was a mid play audible, by the way. Actually, it's on the different lined up, but I decided to go with the Christmas decorations because it was clearly visible from your YouTube video.
Yeah. See, you can see you've got my stocking, Jesse's stocking, Vinny's stocking, and baby's stocking. We're ready to go.
That's the first official announcement on this show, right?
Yes, I think it is. Yeah.
So,
well, I announced it on Facebook earlier this morning, so...
I didn't see
it. Breaking news right here.
Breaking news. We got breaking news, people. That's very cool. That is very cool.
Well, I forgot to start recording, so hopefully you got this.
YouTube, we believe in you. So, cool. I was going to go with the...
Good to lead with, yeah.
You what?
What were you going to lead with?
I was going to lead with the my cleanly shaven brother. Hope, you know, end of No Shave November.
Yeah, that's right. That's why I am cleanly shaven. You are not, though.
Yeah, I'm more cleanly shaven than I was. As you were well aware, I had the full beard going. And last year I grew a pretty gnarly beard out, too. And... went straight to the mustache for a couple of months, and I enjoyed that. I liked the look a lot, but there was just for fun, you know, when you're shaving for fun, you do it in phases, right? You know, you do the chops, you do the goatee, you do the handlebars, and at the handlebar phase, I really liked it, but I decided to just keep going to the mustache anyways, and I regretted that for an entire year. So this year, I decided to not make the same mistake, and I decided to shave the beard and just go for the full handlebars. And
those are pretty gnarly, man. How low are those hanging?
Oh man, I got an inch and a half. I don't have a measuring tape, but yeah, I mean it's kind of ridiculous.
It looks like it's a different color almost. Am I seeing that right?
Than my mustache?
Yeah.
Yeah, you've never noticed? I have a red mustache. I mean, it's a dark red, but it's definitely mostly red hairs. Whereas my face, facial hair is one of the weirdest genetic things that, like, you know, expressions of genetics that you can get. Because we've got just a pinch of Irish in us. I mean, just an unbelievably small amount. And in me, it's basically not present at all except in my mustache. And there's just a tiny little bit of Irish there, and it's just the red hairs come through. So my mustache and then my beard is full-blown German brown, you know, simple. Keep it Slavic. But, yeah, and it's a look, man.
Looks good. How long are you going to keep the look for?
I don't know. My boss said something the first day, so it may not make it to next week.
What did he say? Like, that's so amazing, never shave it?
Nah, so, you know, I don't want to say it was the exact opposite, but...
You're not traveling anywhere the rest of the year. Who cares?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but we unfortunately, we meet with clients, and we meet with... As the engineer of my company, the engineering manager, we meet with outsiders a bit. And, you know, as long as it looks clean and like I'm doing it on purpose, I can get away with an awful lot. But this might be a bridge too far.
That's fair.
But it's funny. I like looking at people looking at me. And at different phases of what I'm dressed in, how I look and stuff, just study crowds and whatnot. And, you know, when I'm like really trim beard, like, you know, dressed to the T's, feeling fit and good, you know, I get the girls all, you know, catching them and they catch their looks and everything. It's kind of nice, feeling good about yourself. And then as the beard gets longer, starts to get into that phase of like some girls like it, but you know, mostly it's just like dudes will be like checking it out. And like nowadays, like nobody looks at me except little kids. It's kind of weird. It's like this is a statement I've realized, and that's probably the most like that's the weirdest part about it, is realizing that, you know, it's just, to me it's just a hairstyle that I'm doing temporarily. But, you know, people look around and see the full handlebars. They're like, is he going to kill us? I think he might kill us. But kids are fascinated by it because they, like, never see it. So they will just stare relentlessly as you walk.
Trying to figure it out.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Yeah, is that attached to his face all the way, or is that just a mustache coming down? But you know what, James? You know what we're not here to talk about today? We're not here to talk about facial hair all day, though I probably could. Instead, this week, like every week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that, we mean the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and, of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James has a short disclosure he wants to throw away.
I work for Hewlett-Packard. However, I do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions.
All right, I like it. If you want to follow us throughout the week, see things like Christmas decorations as they go up and us getting into our festive time of year and things along those lines, we're all over the social.
Mustaches, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're all over the social networks. Specifically, Matthew D. Frillo is my Twitter, and NextWiggin4 is my Instagram. Go check her out.
I am James Furlow at Twitter, on Instagram, LinkedIn, everywhere, Flickr. Actually, I'm not that on Flickr.
You're not?
That was not my username. No. That was back when I had a different one. It was my gamer tag, actually, FurlowPro27.
Ah, gotcha.
Xbox Live gamer tag. Not that I have an Xbox or a gold account. But it's cool. You can friend me up.
Hey. Yeah, so.
So.
I'm trying to. At this point in the show, we actually have a note that we never pay attention to called the social interaction bag. And I've been debating this all week because I feel like there's been a lot of talk. And I don't like doing this to people because it's just not much fun. Well, it's fun for me, but I've realized that other people don't enjoy it very much. So I need your advice. Okay, about the lightsaber. People keep talking about it. And I'm wondering, do I give my analysis, which I promise is correct. Now, it doesn't use anything.
Did you watch the Stephen Colbert video?
I have. And this is my trick. I will not use any information other than three sources: the six movies in a trailer, J.J. Abrams, what he said, and just general knowledge of marketing to explain what the heck that's what it is. But I feel like it's kind of a killjoy because I'm going to tell you what to expect in the movies, and I will be right, and it'll be kind of annoying if you're looking to be surprised and enthralled. So I need your advice, James. Do I do it?
Yeah.
What?
Keep it to yourself. That's easy.
Oh, okay.
Or if you want, I can put my earphones off. You can just talk. And then when you're done, give me some sort of signal, and I'll come back on.
All right. I can do that. All right. If you don't want to listen, stop listening now. This is the deal with the lightsaber. It's pretty simple. the whole principle is the Sith are dead, so the Sith are coming, or the non-Sith are coming back. It's a new version of the Sith, right? That's the end of the sixth movie. The Force is awakening. The bad guys are coming back. There's a general lack of knowledge that is gone, including the making of lightsabers, hence the flickering lightsaber. There's going to be some people saying, no, man, it's already been a style in the expanded universe, but J.J. Abrams not going to pay attention to that, except in, like, the most general of terms. So basically what you're seeing here is an extended lightsaber built off of an old design that he doesn't have complete instructions for, which means it's also an incomplete fighting style that he's going to be using. It is not going to be used for catching lightsabers sliding down the hilt. There's no need for that. You've never seen anything like that. He will catch a lightsaber with the hilt at some point, I guarantee it, just because, hey, it's going to look cool. But ultimately, the purpose of it is for a secondary attacking weapon, and that's the explanation. Look forward to the fact that the Sith are going to be rising again and have a complete new religion, and that's it. It's simple. It's not. It's just like, come on. Anyways, I'm back. I'm waving to James now. I'm signaling him coming back.
Did you reveal all secret?
Okay. Yeah, pretty much. It's not even that, like... What?
Sweet.
Yeah. Cool. I hope people aren't disappointed by the reality of it.
Not me, because I am living in denial.
I don't blame you.
What is it? When you don't know. There's a term for that.
There is a term for that, James. And you're very ignorant of it.
Yeah, if only I could remember that. All right, man.
Let's actually do this. It's time. Am I up first?
Oh, no, I guess not. I guess I was expecting you to say, like, visit Stefan, furloughbros.com and whatever.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, furloughbros.com. So, holy cow, I totally forgot. I was so distracted by Star Wars. So you should go to the... go to our website, furloughbros.com. It's where we put all the clicks and links for everything we talk about, any videos, any audio, any articles. It's all there. Check it out. We've also got a link to the podcast if you're coming from YouTube, or a link to YouTube if you're coming from the podcast. That is our gift to you this Christmas season. You're welcome.
All right. Cool. I'm going to go first. Okay. I love airplanes.
I bet you do.
And... I saw this article, technically it was published last month, but, you know, whatever. We were distracted that week with Thanksgiving and such. So did you know that it has been more than 10 years since the Concorde made its final transatlantic flight?
That's crazy.
I know, right? So that era is gone, but a new one is approaching.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, there's a new generation of supersonic passenger aircraft that are getting ready to emerge at 2020, which, you know, is only like 5 years away.
That is. It's barreling down upon us.
Yeah, it is. And what's interesting is that, like all good competitive markets, it's not just one, but there's a few that are getting after it. Ooh, the first one is a jet called the N+2. Which I'm really hoping is a temporary name. It's being designed by Lockheed Martin. It's intended for commercial use. Get this. They want to cut the travel time from New York to L.A. by half, from 5 hours to just 2.5.
That's not bad, man.
Here's the bad thing. The aircraft will hold 80 passengers.
That is going to be wicked expensive.
Yes. I'm doing quick math in my head. That's not going to work.
Okay. Although I will say this, this is not how math works, but, you know, if you can do one trip in 2 hours, that means you can do two trips in 4 hours, which means that's effectively, like, let's bring it to the logical conclusion, right? So 5 hours, you said 5 hours or 4 hours is the normal trip? No, it's 5 hours, right?
Yeah, 5 hours.
5 hours is the normal trip, so you could do, let's say, how many people could you...
No. No? No, it's not about time, it's about fuel costs.
Well, yeah, but if you spend less...
Why isn't much fuel?
No.
Oh, apparently
I'm going really fast. Like, you spend less time in the air. You don't spend... It's not a... There's not like a foot. Think about it. Your car, you're going 25 miles per hour. Do you burn more gas going, you know, let's say you go 25 miles in your car at 25 miles per hour. Are you going to burn more gas doing that than you would going 50 and doing it in half the time?
There's a bell curve here. The question is, where are we on this bell curve?
Yeah. No, it's not going to be cheap.
Because I'm pretty sure if you're trying to go 100 miles an hour, you're going to use more gas than at 25 miles per hour.
Well, and it's a terrible analogy because combustion motors are optimized for a particular speed. Cars are all optimized for about 55 miles per hour. And so they do.
Can you optimize at a different speed?
Oh, yeah. You can optimize them for 25 miles per hour or for 100 miles per hour.
Okay. Well, then I guess it's possible.
Well, yeah, but the thing is,
that's going to be their trick, right? Is they got to.
But the thing is that airplanes actually, the reason why, well, this is interesting. One of the big reasons why they take smaller airplanes across the Atlantic than they used to is because they fly slower so they can use less gas. Because it turns out that going through, because this is what happens. At supersonic speeds, air resistance goes through the roof and it actually becomes much, much harder to move forward. It becomes more like swimming and less like flying. And so you're actually, it requires a tremendous amount of force just to get up to the high speed. So there's no way it's going to be cheaper. And the faster you go, the more people you move, the harder it becomes. Like at some point you start to reach, I mean, like once you hit supersonic, you start to get into the realm of the aircraft starts heating up as you go faster and faster, which, you know, below that speed, it actually gets colder because heat's being wicked away by the wind. But the resistance becomes so high that the friction starts to increase, and, you know, you get the returning spacecraft effect going on. That was me throwing out bad engineering, even though I knew it. Sometimes it's fun.
Well, I'm not an engineer, so I fooled me, I guess. Okay, so that's the first one.
Okay, I like it, though.
The N2. Oh, yeah. And you just say the idea that they're going after. It's cool. The other one, I think this is a horrible name, by the way, is the Ariane AS2.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what's with these names. I don't get it, but whatever. So the Ariane AS2 is – this one's crazy. It's a business jet, okay? This one flies at about, or they think it will, at about 1,200 miles per hour. The Concorde, by the way, was 1,300 miles per hour. Yeah, yeah. So this one's being put together with Airbus and Ariane. They're doing it in Nevada. What's interesting is that they think the cost of the airplane is going to be about $100 million.
No, that's, you know, affordable, I guess.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's going to, again, it's for business class. So it's got a luxurious 30-foot cabin that can seat up to 12 passengers.
Up to 12 passengers?
Yes. It's business. Not commercial.
Yeah. Obviously, it's business.
This is for when they give some – I felt like they gave some stats here on how fast this one would go. Also, modern commercial jets typically cruise around like 500 miles per hour, to kind of give context, maybe 550. I feel like they were given some like you could go to Japan in like 5 hours type thing. Pretty fast. But yeah, so there's some companies out there.
Yeah.
Ariane and Lockheed Martin. They're getting into the supersonic jet space. Apparently, they've detected a consumer need for that and have been working on the development of these super fast planes. We'll see if it comes back.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Which, you know, there was the Hyperloop, but, you know, whatever. It's...
Right. Well, and I mean, there were some real problems that the Concorde was having. That just difficulties. It's like, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting. The Concorde is an interesting history, and it's It was surprisingly difficult to do. It'll be interesting. It will be very fascinating to see how they come up against those challenges, like the fact
that... So it sounded like there's a couple things that they're doing that are game changers.
Okay.
Say it. Computers are smarter. They're faster.
Yes. I'm surprised that that has that big of a advantage. Well, okay.
They were saying that it's going to help, for lack of a better term, manage and fly the airplane.
They're going to do fly-by-the-wire sort of thing?
Yeah, I think, sure. I don't know what that means, but sure.
Basically, have a computer fly it, and you just sort of... You with the control stick, you politely ask the computer to make the plane do something, and then it does something that approaches that as best it can without killing everybody.
Yeah, yeah, yes. That's how I understand it. And computers are just faster, and they're smarter, and they've got more sensors everywhere now. And I think, you know, they're making improvements all the time in reducing drag and efficiency and all that stuff, which is also going to help. And so it requires less fuel to, you know, to go that same speed, which is nice. But I think that's a good idea right there.
I just remember one of the big dilemmas that they had was the fact that supersonic jets can't easily fly over populated areas, because if they're super high up, you can still hear the sonic boom as it passes over you, and that's a lot of complaints.
Which one was it? I believe it was the Lockheed one. They figured out how to do this. It's got a jet on the top, then two jets under the wing or something like that, and what that does is it reduces that sonic boom somehow magically. I don't know.
Interesting. I guess I'm not, it's not like a law of physics that there has to be a sonic boom. To me, that was always one of your biggest hurdles, is it was, you know, ultimately it was the crash that really you got these incredibly expensive, you know, tickets to fly the Concorde, right? Very, very wealthy people. And, you know, and then all of a sudden to sit there and go, oh, it's dangerous, but that was really just the straw that broke the camel's back. It was expensive. It was very difficult to operate. And in the sonic concussion was a huge issue. I mean, it was just like, it was insurmountable. And because I remember like French farmers would complain all the time because they'd fly over. It turns out that grapes and tomatoes, which are two of France's primary fruit exports, don't really like massive concussive, you know, and concussive sound waves flying over them. And they would literally, as they'd hit, you know, as they'd go over, and like, oftentimes we think of a sonic boom as a moment, right? It's just a boom, it hits you. But that's like, that's the wrong way to think about it. That's the pressure wave as it passes over you. It's a continuous pressure wave that follows the trajectory of the thing generating it, and they would literally wipe out entire farms and vineyards of tomatoes and grapes, just explode them on the vines, which was, you know, the French weren't thrilled about.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
So, you know, there are challenges. It'll be interesting to see how they how they actually dealt with it. Was they said, okay, we won't go supersonic over residential areas.
Sounds like that AS2. They said it will fly subsonic speeds until it reaches the ocean, and then it'll speed up.
Right, and that's
it says over Europe, it can fly at supersonic speeds without detection. I don't know what that means.
I don't know what that means either.
Yeah.
But I guess that's
what that means.
Yeah. But my point is, you know, it's just that was one of the reasons why it became so expensive, because the whole promise of it was that, oh, it'll be 2 hours from Asia to England, or, you know, whatever. It'll be super short period of time. And that never came to fruition. It was really only good for crossing the Pacific and the Atlantic, which is useful, but the cost of the Concorde development program and everything made it cost prohibitive to take advantage of that, because there were large swaths. You couldn't even cross the Americas with it. It was literally, if you were going from Europe to America, or from California to New York, or from California to Asia. You know, it's interesting. That'll be good. I look forward to it. I'm glad they're doing something, because
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyways, so a couple weeks back, Kim Kardashian tried to break the internet and didn't, and just, you know, proved herself to be a... What?
How did she try to do that?
Wow. Dude, yeah. I know. She was on the cover of a magazine that nobody pays attention to, where she was largely unclothed, and the title of the article was "The Image That Broke the Internet" or something like that. It was stupid, and basically just generated a lot of talk about what is your deal? Like, what are you doing? And people tried to shoehorn it into a lot of the narratives of the day and the news and stuff, but it's mostly just dumb. And there was no breaking of the internet at all. As opposed, and I juxtapose that thought to Psy, who actually broke YouTube. And Google was impressed. Basically, what the deal was. So they've got the view counter on YouTube, right? It tells you how many times people have seen a video. Yep. Well, turns out they were storing that information as a signed integer. And for those of you, a 32-bit signed integer. And for those of you who know computer science, basically what that means is that there's a certain number that you reach that can't be stored beyond that number of placeholders. It'd be like saying if you had if a number had six digits, you couldn't store a number bigger than 999,999. Because you don't have any more places to store them. Well, that's the same thing happens with binary numbers, but they don't have these nice round numbers. Well, that number happened to be somewhere in the 2 billion ballpark, and Psy passed that. That number is 2,147,483,647 views. He broke the YouTube counter. Google, being the tech professionals that they are, quickly fixed it, doubling the number of bits that could be stored to a 64-bit integer, which means you got to get to like 9 quintillion, I think, is the new the new target. Exponentially more views, which they doubt will be reached in the near future. But it is interesting to think that back when YouTube was created, they figured 32-bit energy is fine. They'll never cross that threshold. And like, oh my gosh, they did. it's a testament to how much bigger YouTube is than even YouTube thought they were going to be. Not just size achievements. I don't know, just a interesting little moment in internet history. By the way, Gangnam Style, for the record, in case you were wondering if it was one of his other hits. It wasn't. But this does...
That gif that they have of him jumping up and explosion in the background.
It's a great video.
I don't know about great video, but it's entertaining for sure.
Okay, there we go. But this was interesting. So it sort of sparked a discussion about what are the most viewed videos on the YouTubes. So I got a list of the top 30 most viewed YouTube videos as of December 2014.
Oh, so, fantastic.
Right? So Gangnam Style is at number one with 2.15 billion views. Coming in at just over half of the number of views is Justin Bieber's Baby, Baby. That one. I'm not going to sing it anymore. That was terrible. Wow. So the Biebs.
That guy is popular, huh?
Right? and then right after that, one of the all-time memes, Charlie bit my finger again at 804 million. At this point, you start having the precipitous drop in views. It goes from 804 million at number 3 to 495 million at number 30. So they're all, in the same ballpark. So after Charlie Bit My Finger, we get J-Lo on the floor. Then one of my favorites, LMFAO's Party Rock Anthem. And then Shakira's...
So what I'm noticing here is Charlie Bit My Finger Again is the only one of the top 30 that is not a music video.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of what I was going to go for. Psy comes back around number 9. Then we get Kat Perry at Roar. It's that I've lost count of who these are. Yeah, Carly Rae Jepsen, who is arguably kind of meme-ish, but a music video nonetheless. At Call Me Maybe, Lady Gaga with Bad Romance, Goye, Somebody That I Used to Know, One Republic, Counting Stars, it's a good one. Psy, again, at Opus, Just My Style, but now we're in like the 26s. Rihanna at Diamonds, and then finally Avicii's wrapping up the list with Wake Me Up. And which is just, yeah, like you said, it's just fascinating. And then when they do it, YouTube videos with the most views per day in December 14, it is entirely music videos. And it's basically the same music videos until you get down, just reordered, until you get down to Charlie Bit My Finger Again at 292,000 views a day. There are 292,000 people every day watching that video. I mean, I know it's more astounding that there are 2.46 million people watching Gangnam Style anyway, so the only non-music video that rounds out the top 30 daily views is Charlie Bit My Finger Again. Which means that every other one on that list are, you know, coming up on it quickly. And J-Lo is going to pass it at the current rate. We'll pass it probably in the next month. And, you know, unless things, change up and all of a sudden there's a resurgence in interest in Charlie Bit My Finger, it'll just keep plunking down the list until it's all music videos, which kind of fits into this bigger narrative of the fact that T-Swift didn't take her music off of took her music off of Spotify but not YouTube. Sort of the idea that music execs don't really get how kids use YouTube, and Google does, though. They've figured out the fact that this is one of the biggest music streaming services out there, and if not the biggest. And that's the whole monetizing it with music key, because the worst part about these statistics is these are the most watched videos, but it doesn't include the number of times that those songs are like lyric videos or, you know, remixed, or somebody singing the same video and the song just gets played again and again and again. And every time YouTube tags it as a song that, hey, this song belongs to this person, and any money's made off of that particular video, that artist gets it's a fascinating little, it's a fascinating trend that's going on. And, you know, just makes you wonder what the heck MTV and VH1 have been doing for the last decade and a half. Like, seriously, obviously music videos still have some sway. Arguably the on-demand nature of the videos is, has something to do with it, with YouTube, but they ain't dead. That's the important part.
Yeah, that's just, I'm surprised, you know, I didn't even think that type of surprise, as opposed to I don't believe it surprised. That's just fascinating. That does just reek to you, like, there's an opportunity sitting here. We're looking at the data, millions of summarized data, billions, I guess, technically. It's not dead. It's not even close to dead. It's just moved.
Yep. Yeah, and what I think is really interesting, as is quite often the case when it comes to the media and companies and stuff, is that, like you said, it's just a missed opportunity. It's people don't understand. They don't get what's going on, that there is a trend, things are moving, and there's a different way of looking at it. And if you can be the first one to capitalize on that, there is space, man. There is a real space there. And I don't know. It's sort of the whole Moneyball effect, which I watched last Sunday finally.
Great, isn't it?
It is very, very, very good. But it's that exact same argument, as if we take all this information, look at it a little bit differently, and, you know, and try to change things up, we can have some real success. And you know, obviously to great success, where they changed the nature of baseball and how baseball is played. It's fascinating. It's really fascinating when you look at it this way and just sit there and go, yeah, Spotify, no wonder Spotify was so irked by Taylor Swift. They're like, what the heck? We're not even close to the biggest. Like, we're nothing. Why are you punishing us? Which does make you wonder, like, Taylor Swift's a pretty smart girl. What was the idea there? What was her strategy? Why did she pull it from
I don't think she's Spotify. I just don't think they did. I don't think anybody did. I mean, it caught YouTube by surprise.
It's true.
You know, I've got to imagine that, I don't want to say it. This revelation that he broke YouTube, it will not become readily obvious to us, you and I, right away, because we're not in it. But I think this just rocked the world of a whole bunch of labels and artists and, you know, music media companies. It's suddenly you go, oh, this is a thing. And we all kind of like, you know, you see it and you go, you know what? I believe it. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us realized it was this big or this dominant. I mean, I know that was the fear with, like, you know, at one time they're like, oh, it's all going to become professional content and stuff like that. And, you know, and Hulu was of the, well, we're just going to jump straight to that and only do professional content. And, you know, and the idea behind YouTube was, well, you know, anyone could post a video. We're doing it right now. And, you know, you don't have to be a professional.
Hey, I was going to say, I do not like where that was going.
Don't worry. You know, but the idea would be, you know, there was also clearly, I forget what it was. It was like for every hour of viewing time, like 24 hours, the video was being uploaded, and it was some crazy ratio. And the idea was, like, in order, it was going to become a louder and noisier landscape, and therefore the ones who produced higher quality content would be the ones that surfaced to the top. And I guess it's like, yeah, you take it to the natural conclusion, all of the, in theory, the most entertaining videos, because that's what they are, professionally done music videos are going to rise to the very, very top. I don't know. Right. There's something here. I can feel it. I'm not a music exec, so I can't like quite put my finger on it.
What I think is interesting is that I wonder how many people, like, I've always tried to think about music videos differently. I don't know if I'm actually successful at that or not, but this sort of idea that you know, what is a music video? It's basically a full-length TV ad for the album. That was sort of the genesis of it. And, you know, it was this new medium, and people were just trying to, you know, you get these, your first music videos were just people trying to catch the attention in a unique way. It was a form of advertising. It also, and then all of a sudden the creation of MTV and VH1 and this idea of these channels that were dedicated to music videos because they have an art to them. And some of them really heavy on the art, some of them really heavy on the, you know, on the, promotion side. You know, what's the purpose of these? But they're all a little bit of both. Or some of both, at least, some more than others. But in the end, you ended up with these things that, you know, executives never really thought of them as their own thing. Nobody really, except MTV, thought of them as their own thing. But it was sort of weird because it was like, basically, MTV was started as this really cool young guy version or young, you know, kid version of like your shopping network. It was just endless advertisements for music albums played on repeat,
right.
You know, which is kind of how they viewed the whole idea of the radio stations. You know, the musicians get a cut of that, or you know, the labels get a cut of that. They get paid for that, but that's not where they make the majority of their money, with very few exceptions. Most of that is just viewed as like free advertising or paid ad. You know, they getting paid to advertise for their albums. And what's really interesting was that for a long time, I think it's illegal now, but radios would like the, you know, execs would pay radio stations to play their music that, and and because they realized it was an advertising campaign to get the album, to get the going and get people to buy the album and get people to go to the show and sort of push this whole thing forward, you know, and YouTube is sitting there thinking, Google is sitting there looking at this going, well, we've, you know, this is this, people are playing the music and putting it into a playlist, setting the music going, minimizing the tab, and then going in about their work and just using it as a giant playlist that plays video in the background, which is rough for YouTube because that's a lot of data that they're sending around that people aren't actually watching the videos. And then you ask the question of, but are they? Like when you think, why is Gangnam Style the top one? It's because it's, like you said, it's an entertaining video. And most of those have some sort of, you know, visually stunning thing going on in the background. And I don't know, that whole interplay of like, what is, you know, what is the point of a music video? Is it its own thing? Is it a very, you know, is it an advertisement? Is it a, you know, what is it? And I think that ultimately is why Taylor Swift didn't think about YouTube. It's because the whole argument is that YouTube or music videos are an advertisement for the entire album, whereas Spotify was the entire album for free, effectively, as far as they were concerned. But the entire album's been uploaded to YouTube. You can listen to the entire thing in a playlist and get all the, you know, of all the lyric videos. And so it's, I don't know, it's just such a weird thing that's going on right now. And even Music Key kind of acknowledges that they're, it's hard to define what is actually covered by Music Key and what isn't and why, you know, because they're not really sure what constitutes music on YouTube. You know, you watching some video, you're trying to learn how to do a particular type of haircut, and you're watching some guy give an example of it in a barbershop, and Shakira's Waka Waka comes on, or is that J-Lo? I don't know, it doesn't matter. Comes on in the background, and it's playing over the background. Is that considered a music video? You know, oftentimes YouTube will silence that part of the video if it's not something that's covered under their licensing agreement, because they can tell that the music's there. You know, like you said, they're doing so much data analysis as it comes in. Anyways.
It's cool.
It is cool.
Let's talk about the Internet of Things.
All right, so this is my question, James. This is what has been proposed, and I want to get your thoughts on if it's accurate or not. Basically, the idea is the Internet of Things, the IoT, is reaching escape velocity. Lots of technologies sort of get interest, pay attention to them, and then they don't actually take off. They just sort of, you know, meander around and. Nobody, you know, there's a lot of talk about it, but until big companies and stuff really get involved, it doesn't become its own thing.
Like NFC.
Exactly. And that one felt like it was really getting close to escape velocity. And there's some, and now there's obviously with Apple, there's a resurgence of that, but it still doesn't feel like it's definitely not what we thought it was going to be as a,
right.
As a
because technology. It has not lived up to its expectations. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wait.
Right. I was thinking did not expect Apple Pay to work the way it does because NFC has not lived up to those expectations. Everyone thought it was always primed to take off, and it never has.
Right. So
what's your question?
So with the Internet of Things, there's a couple of things that are going on that would suggest that we're starting to reach the point where it's sort of becoming its own real technology. Number one, there's the explosion of startup activity. We talked about it a while back, a couple of months ago, about the idea of hardware in hardware startups, and that hardware startups have been very, very rare in the Valley for the last couple of years, and all of a sudden they're starting to come more and more and more. VCs are because there's just a completely different development style and view of it. And it wasn't where all the excitement was, but now VCs and angels are starting to look at it and say, you know, maybe there's something here. We should get involved, and they're starting to invest in it. Number two, big companies are coming in. So obviously, you know, I talk a lot about my Hue light bulbs. Google bought Nest and their suite of products. GE is getting in the game. Apple has come out with HomeKit, sort of your home, you know, tying everything together. So both on the industrial hardware side and the software technology side, big companies are starting to get into the space and kind of feel out how do we want to do this. There's more and more acquisitions and mergers going on. Nest, perfect example of, you know, being acquired by a big company. Basis, Dropcam, SmartThings, Revolve, even Oculus, they all sort of fit into that. These big companies that are tying everything together, getting bought by the bigger companies. And so the bigger companies are getting involved in it.
You've also got this interesting, like, how do I describe it? Expanding definition of the Internet of Things, similar to what happened with, like, Web 2.0. Where I was like, what is the Web 2.0? Is it glossy buttons? Is it APIs and widgets? Is it, what was the other one? Social interaction, right? Remember there was all these, like, depending on how you looked at it, that was all Web 2.0.
Right.
And it was like, we could all clearly see, like, something's different, but we could not define it. And so we kept expanding that definition to try to capture what this phenomenon was that was going on.
Yeah, like,
kind of are getting, oh, go ahead.
I mean, say Oculus, I think, fits into that. You know.
Yeah, because that one, it's not, I don't know if I'd put that in the Internet of Things category, but it's the same feeling of like, no, there's something different going on here, and we don't know how to define it, and so we're just going to call everything that's not a tablet or computer an Internet of Things.
Yeah.
But we don't want to say that because that sounds too dumb, and so we're trying to expand it. I mean, I just get that feeling because I look at the Oculus and I go, that's not an Internet of Things. Now, what I think of Internet of Things, you know, I do think Nest for sure. And the example that I like almost instantly thought of was I've got a smartwatch that I can control my Nest with from anywhere in the world.
Right.
Press a couple buttons. I can see what the temperature is in my home and I can adjust it at will if I want to, or I can set it to away if needed. You know, I have these options, and I look at that and go, like, I that was just where my head immediately went, and I realized that's a blending of the two, even.
It's part connectivity, it's part data acquisition, it's part automation and controls, and it's difficult to define exactly, you know, what does it mean? And I think what the idea, though, is that, to me, the biggest general push is that it's anything that pushes the connectivity beyond PCs and laptops. To me, it's funny. I would actually define the Internet of Things as that when you cross the threshold from purely done on a computer for I would almost say if it requires a human user interface, it's not an Internet of Things, because it's sort of this meshing of, you know, of the real world and putting the internet in everything. So all of your things are connected to the rest of the world. And that is such an overwhelming idea that it requires a bunch of automation, a bunch of processing power, and a tremendous amount of back-end support, and so that you can open up your phone or your look at your watch and very quickly glean just the tip of the iceberg, very, 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 very tip of the iceberg, because there's just too much otherwise. And I wonder, yeah, it's hard to define, and I think we all have our own definitions. But like you said,
well, I think it's, we all, you know, coming back to what your original question is, right? Is it ready to, you know, or is it starting, or is it reaching escape velocity? However you want to think about it, which I kind of want to know more about what that would mean. But I think we all want it to, you know? And so we're all kind of bending the definition, you know, or not bending it, but we're biasing ourselves to say yes, and here's why, you know, as opposed to saying, well, let's look at what's actually going on and come up with an independent conclusion of what's happening here. Because I think we all want it to, right? We've all got that, you know, that Jetson dream, you know, where it's like, yeah, I want to, you know, we've talked about this on the podcast, right? I want to get an alert that, you know, when my washing machine finishes, that tells me, hey, it's done, come change me. I want, you know, we want to be able to change our temperatures at will. We want it so that when we are a mile, so we had this is actually pretty sweet. So we were driving home last Sunday.
Yeah.
You know, from California, from your neck of the woods home. Mm. And, you know, we were getting home around, like, it was like, I don't know, it was like 9 o'clock at night, something like that. And, you know, it's cold because it's winter here. And we got about 20 minutes away from home. And, you know, and I'm driving there and I pull up my watch and I go, okay, Jess, I'm going to heat up the house for us so that it's nice and toasty warm when we get home.
Oh, man.
Right? And she was like, that's amazing. And
that is amazing.
And, but it's that idea of like, I want to get to the point where I don't even have to do that. Right. It's able to like, it looks at, my thermostat looks at where I'm at and where I'm headed. It looks at, say, I don't know, my calendar or something like that. And it's like, dude, James is coming home. You know, I got to prepare the house for him. And so, you know, 20 minutes before I get home, it starts heating up the house. So it's at the temperature I want it to. As I'm rounding the corner, you know, lights are turning on just like at your place. And then as I'm pulling into the driveway or, you know, wherever, the garage doors are already opening up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, welcome home. We're ready for you. And we all want that. You know, there cannot be a single person on this planet, except for those weirdos who are like, yeah, that does not sound awesome at all.
Right.
You know, we're all like, that sounds cool. You know, obviously we want it done intelligently and smartly. And so all that to say, we're already biased towards that. We want that dream. And so it's in our best interest to say, yes, it's happening. This is it. Look. Because then all these other companies are like, oh, I guess it's happening. We should do it. This is worth investing in. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And like that's what you're seeing. And you could see like these writers on TechCrunch were like, they want it even worse than we do.
Yeah. And so
it's happening. It's here, guys. It's here. Here, quick, all you startups, start investing. Look, we have all these other startups who are doing it. Why haven't you done it yet? Look, the big companies are getting in. Other big companies, get in. Well, you still can. There's opportunity here. It's launching.
That's yeah. Yeah.
And I'm excited, just like everyone else, about it. I'm not going to poo-poo it. I think they're right.
Yeah, I agree. Well, it's funny because I think I've said it on the show before, but I'm very much of the belief that, and sometimes we like to think of, we talk about with computer technology, we often talk about Moore's law, right? That the and Moore's law was that every 18 months, what he had seen was that every 18 months the size of the transistor had halved. Which meant that every 18 months, then you could double the number of transistors on the same size chip, which allowed more computational power, and that had certain yeah. cost savings as things went on, and so things became it was an exponential growth of the number of transistors, and what happened was it gave a clear and expected – it gave a clear roadmap that investors felt that they could dump huge amounts of money into it, knowing that there would be, okay, this is what we expect to happen over the next, you know, 10 years because they had this trajectory. And what's interesting about that is that we call it Moore's Law as though it were a law of nature, but it's not actually. And it's funny when you really look at the data points, there were times that where we way outpaced Moore's Law, followed by periods where we underpaced Moore's Law. And the average is, yeah, a continuous increment, you know, it basically overall matching Moore's Law. But it does make you wonder if Moore had never made that observation, investors had never gotten involved, like,
right.
Would we A, be a lot slower, the most likely outcome, but if nobody had ever defined the expectations, or if somebody had defined their expectations differently, Could we have outpaced Moore's Law? Could we have even gone faster than
that? What Mark Zuckerberg was doing with his whole sharing thing. He didn't really have the data, but he wanted the data, and so he said it. I get that sense sometimes.
Yeah.
And he had something that he could ground it in that people understood and would make headlines. I just get that, like, oh, I'm supposed to share more, I guess. That's what I do.
Right, yeah, exactly.
I get that feeling with him where his was, and this is appropriate, more of a social construction than an actual data-driven observation.
Yeah, and I just...
Social engineering.
Yeah. Well, and it goes back to that whole idea of...
Social engineer. That's bad.
Yeah, right?
Maybe not bad.
But my broader point in this is that it's like technology is driven by individuals, and you know, and we go back to the pivot that we took in cell phone technology when the iPhone came out. A small group of individuals said, "Hey, we want to do it this different way," and it caused a massive pivot that everybody chased down. It wasn't an inevitability. That wasn't or maybe it may have been an inevitability, but. Ultimately, the timing of it, the construction of it, all of that stuff is determined by individuals taking big steps. And like you said, saying, I don't know if it's going this way, but or like there's no proof that it's going this way. But if I stated boldly of course, there's some natural inevitability here, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that's part of what's going on, though. Like you said, it becomes this big feedback loop of more technologies coming out. The you know, Google goes out and says, hey, we want you to buy a Nest. So they start hitting up, you know, their different channels to try to get the word out on how cool Nest is. So people start buying Nest, and people start buying Nest. So other companies go, hey, getting into this tech stuff, well, we should make something that works into that ecosystem, like a camera. And then those get taken off, and, you know, and it's sort of they all, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note, the reason why that works is the products are genuinely cool.
It's true.
They are actually useful. You don't buy a Nest because of the hype, and then, which, mine's right there for my disclosure. You don't buy a Nest because of all the hype, and then take it home and go, it wasn't as cool as I thought it was. You know, because then the hype loop stops. You know, so this was again last week. You and I were hanging out. We went to Home Depot because we were looking for magnets or something.
Yes.
And secret project.
Which, by the way, this morning. Woo! Right here. Get the magnets. I'm not gonna boom
too nice.
close to my computer because you know.
Yeah, it's probably smart. Yeah, unless you want a little dot on your screen.
All right.
And so anyways, does that still work with LCD monitors or
not really? Well,
CRTs.
I'm gonna.
Yes.
No, it doesn't work.
All right, we're good. Just screws up your internals. Okay.
They're not nearly powerful enough.
We were at Home Depot, and they were selling the Wink that Jeff Goldblum is helping to promote. Fantastically well, I may add. But here's an example of something where, like, from a promotional and hype standpoint, did great, you know? I don't share a ton of commercials, and that was one where I was like, I have to share this. This commercial is amazing. Yeah. They were selling this Wink for 99 cents. That's a penny less than a dollar.
For the record.
Quick math. Okay. Though, to be fair, we were in California and there's taxes. And so, you know, whatever. It's more than a dollar. Yeah. It's not as nice as Oregon. But anyways, it was like, if you buy one other thing, you can get this Wink for 99 cents. And unfortunately, I already own a Nest and a Protect. And so it was like 2/3 of their product lineup I already owned. That and I was in California and I wasn't going to pay taxes. But anyways, Yeah, they're giving these things away, essentially, right? Buy one more thing to make this ecosystem worth it, and we'll give you this Wink Hub, which was probably about worth $100, you think, is what they were pricing it at.
Yeah.
Light bulbs were $15-$20, if I remember correctly. For LEDs is in the ballpark-ish of where they should be. But I didn't get one. You didn't get one. I will admit I thought about it for about 30 seconds. It didn't help that the sales guy like didn't fully know what he was talking about and was saying stupid stuff, and I don't like it when they do that. And so it inherently makes me skeptical. But what's interesting is they came up with that awesome commercial. Tons of people shared that commercial. Have you had a lot of people tell you like, oh yeah, I bought the Wink and it's really cool, you should check it out?
No.
Yeah,
I don't know anybody who's in that.
I mean, they're giving these things away, and we live in this tech space, and yet no one seems to be like, oh, yeah, I bought it, totally worth it, you should get in on that. I don't know. I mean, you've talked about the Hue. You've already mentioned it once, unprompted by this article in today's show. You mentioned it multiple other times. It's something that you talk about, and I'm sure that you tell your friends about how cool you are that your lights turn on when you come home and in the morning when it's time to wake up, right?
See, it's absolutely the only reason I get to work on time, when I get to work on
time. Yeah, there you go. Boom. See, you talk about it. That's the word of mouth. And I do not see that with things like the Wink. Sorry, Wink. I'm sure you're cool, but the point being that I think one of the reasons why it is taking off and why, you know, these things are being as successful as they are is they're genuinely good. I want a drop cam. I'll admit it. I don't even have a good use for it. And I'm like, that sounds good. I'd like to know what my dog's up to during the day. Cool.
Right.
It's the monthly recurring cost. I struggle with that. You know, I'm cool with spending. Oh man, excuse me. Ow, that really hurt.
No, that was a weird sound too.
It was like a hiccup burp thingy. Ow.
That was the worst.
Okay. My chest still hurts. Anyways, I'm cool with spending a whole bunch of money up front, like one time. It's the recurring payments that I'm always like, ugh, yeah.
But, hey, man, that's the stuff that adds up.
Right? What do they want? It's $20 a year or $40 a year? I don't even know. They always run these promotions. I'm like, nope, I'm good. But I'm sure if they were
who's that?
Feedly, to become Feedly.
Oh, yeah.
Right? It's like, you do the math and it's like, dude, it's like $2 a month. Big deal. But I'm like, no, it's a recurring cost. I shall cut it.
Yeah, well, it's funny when it comes to gym memberships. For the more expensive gyms, I actually keep telling them, no, I want you to charge me everything up front. Like, I'd actually rather get like a 3-year pro. I'd rather get a 3-year deal where I get, where I get everything all at once. I get just pay it once and it's out of my bank account than get signed up with some, month to month thing. I get that. It's, yeah, I spend more money on music than I should because I don't want to have to be tethered to, Spotify or whatever. Right.
Which is interesting that I actually want to start up a business that's based on subscription payments.
Well,
it's really nice to have a, sustained income stream. So anyway, so I get that. But I want a drop cam just because I think it sounds cool and the technology is generally good. And I think one of the things we're actually noticing too is – I don't want to say it. Products that are going to be better, okay? They're going to add features and capabilities, and they're going to put in quality design.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that adding internet connectivity is a feature, and so it's like, and so you know, there's so I'm trying to say the causation is actually a different route. Is things that are smart that are part of the Internet of Things tend to be better designed because they were going to design them better, and having the internet makes it better.
Right.
And
they're higher quality product. They're not putting internet into their cheapest model refrigerator because that's supposed to be the cheapest model refrigerator. They're putting it into the most expensive ones, which are already very nice.
Right. And they're adding it because, well, we want to justify the cost somehow and make it genuinely better. And that's an easy, very easy way to distinguish it. So, you know, getting back to kind of like that question that you were talking about, right? Is it reaching escape velocity? I'm not going to say quite yet. I'm not ready to be like, oh yeah, this thing's happening. We're it's real. I think we are, I feel like we're like a week ahead of where we should be on this, but that's okay.
Well, why?
Four weeks. When do we do our prediction show?
Oh, yeah. Dude, I've got to start taking notes because I've thought about it like three times in the last week of like, oh yeah, the prediction show's coming up. I'm ready for this. Like, yeah.
So that's my thought is like, will it have reached escape velocity? I'm thinking like, my initial thought was, is it in 6 months or will we be able to confidently say yes a year from now? And I feel like a year from now we will be able to say yes. And now I'm more like, will I be able to say it this summer? Probably not. But
I would, to me, I would, so I would say
supersonic jets come around. Definitely. No question.
Definitely. Oh yeah. 2020 for sure. You'll be able to fly from England in 2 hours with your 5-year-old kid and have your thermostat on by the time you get home.
Boom.
That's crazy to think about. On so many different levels, especially considering the fact that your thermostat already turns on your way home. But no, I would, so yeah, I like what we're talking about with this Internet of Things. The term escape velocity, what does that actually mean? I would say this. It's when it stops being driven by individuals. Like, so I would define it as, you know, with the iPhone, the idea of the full screen touchscreen for a mobile device being your optimal design, design feature or whatever. It was like Apple came in first, not at escape velocity. First couple of years, not at escape velocity. It wasn't until Samsung really started to run away with the Android sales using the exact same design feature as decided by a court of law, literally the same. That was when I would say, you know, you've really hit escape velocity because everybody else was getting in that game and everybody was copying the design, the form factor. And, you know, and it just became its own thing. It no longer required people trying to convince you it was a good idea. It was just self-evident. And so now, everybody was investing.
My next question or thought was, how do we define escape velocity here?
I would say when it become, when you get so many companies and so it would just be kind of, it becomes the zeitgeist that, oh, obviously it's got to have the internet connected to it. I think one of the ways that you'll see that is when you start saying exactly what you talk about. It's when the mid-level refrigerators have Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
It's when I found an instructable on how to add a text alert to your buzzer on your drying machine, BTWs. But it's sort of like, yeah.
Why haven't you shared it yet? I don't understand.
Because I was gonna do that on this show and then I forgot the link at work and I actually have to.
Fair enough.
I don't know how. I just looked for it and somehow that link didn't make it into my, like, didn't make the transition. So I know it's at work. It's just not. Anyways, I think it's because I turned my computer off, which is stupid. But I guess my broader point is it's like you've got this. You're at this point. Or when you get to this point where mid-level things, not your absolute cheapest, because I think it'll be a long time before your absolute cheapest have.
I agree. And I want the absolute cheapest for some things, so it's okay.
Right. But it is, you know, it's sort of like all cars have radios.
I bought 4 refrigerators the other day, and I wanted the absolute cheapest.
I don't blame you.
2 ovens. Oh, man, I spent some money at Home Depot. But one time, yeah. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like, you know, but you think about car stereo systems, right? All cars, you can't buy a new car without a stereo system. That hit escape velocity. That clearly is that idea that you need a stereo in your car.
Well, see, that's different, I think. That's table stakes. You know, that's like commodity now. You have to have it, period.
Right. Well, I would say that's clearly – I'm using that as the definition of clearly the other end. It's fully in orbit.
Yes.
It's doing its thing. We don't have to worry about it anymore. But I would say, you know, the other end obviously
– with analogy. I like it.
Exactly. The other end being, you know, 3D printers where that hasn't hit us. That's not, you know, it's approaching, it's going that direction, but there's still potential. I think there's more of an inevitability there, but we're still not quite across that threshold. And actually let's get an even more nascent technology to get our, what's something really cool. I would say this VR headsets, perfect example of something still very much in its nascent state. There are two companies that are really pushing it big time. Oculus and Sony's going to come out with their solution pretty soon here.
I know you're pumped about that because you're in the Sony ecosystem now, huh?
Oh, baby.
What would you do if Sony came out with something and Oculus came out with something? What would you do? Because I know you're going to get something. Now it's just a question of what.
The PlayStation, buying the PlayStation was, I decided a while ago that I don't want to invest on the entire, because the Oculus is going to require a high-powered video gaming computer, and I didn't want to do that entire thing, whereas getting the PlayStation, it's not going to be as good, but I don't get motion sickness from them, so I figure, whatever, I just want good enough, I want something that's, you know, and I think the Morpheus will, my gamble right now is the Morpheus is going to be good enough. Now, what's going to be really frustrating is if it's not. If it's not good enough, I don't know what I'm going to do. But
I'm excited for that moment.
All right. But anyways, it looks like we got a ways to go because I haven't seen any. They were in the middle of their big keynote about the future of PlayStation this morning, and I didn't get to the end of it, but I didn't see any announcements about it yet. So, you know, maybe by the time we get done with this show.
What was going on this morning?
They're doing their PlayStation thing. They're announcing video games and stuff. It's Saturday. I know. But anyways, I'm gonna do this, James. I'm gonna say I'm not actually going to answer that question because you're absolutely right. I'm putting it in my notes for 4 weeks from now. We've started the conversation.
Cool.
And
stay tuned, there's your teaser.
Yeah, there we go.
All right. Okay. Cool, man. We'll talk more about that. That's good. What time did we start this show? I didn't start recording, so I have no idea. Did we start at noon or a little afternoon?
We'll assume a little afternoon. Well, you came on at 12:07, and I looked at it and I was like, 12:07. I've been here since you asked. You shot a text at 12:07 saying, "Are you ready?" I've been sitting here since 12 because that's when you told me to get here.
Really? I sent yo at like right at 12, and you didn't respond.
You did. I did. You didn't get my yo? It was like the first thing I did. What the heck, dog? I just sent you another one.
I got that one.
Weird.
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
No, you're failing it. That's why I was sitting around waiting for you.
Oh, I get it. Okay. But we started about 12:15, so.
Okay, got it. Cool. All right, cool. All right, this next one, I honestly just want to read the article because it's fantabulous. So I'm going to do a little bit of both because it's fantastic. It's mostly tech related, but it's more commentary on how awesome government is. So, and that was sarcasm. So, the title of this post on Medium is Uber.gov. It's time to let the government drive. Okay. So this guy starts off flying to Vegas. Look to your left. Now look to your right. Statistically speaking, one of you is about to get ripped off by a cabbie. And
it'll
probably be you, the imbecile who chose the middle seat and paid $15 for plain Wi-Fi.
that's pretty good writing.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic article. I'll probably paraphrase it, but I highly recommend you go to furloughbros.com and check out it'll be uber.gov. It's because it's really, really good. He says that taxi scams are nothing new, but here's something novel. The Nevada state government is out innovating Uber in attacking these scofflaws. Okay, so here's how the Sin City Shuffle works. There are two main routes to get from the Las Vegas airport to the Strip. Have you ever flown into Las Vegas before?
No.
Wow.
No.
Cool that you have not. That's amazing.
Oh, I'm going to ruin it for you. I have. It was for a layover.
See, that was me being surprised because I didn't believe it, as opposed to the other one last time. Wait, so a layover. So did you actually go to the Strip then?
No, I didn't.
Oh, so you've been to the airport.
Yes, I've flown into Las Vegas.
Have you been to the Las Vegas Strip before?
I have. Yeah, when we were kids, remember?
But you drove.
I've not been there since I was 21.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. Everybody keeps telling me I should go because I'd enjoy it a lot.
Yeah, you probably would. Wow, that was loud. Text messaging on my computer. Anyways, there's two main routes to get to the Strip. One of which is illegal. Okay, so here's how you to figure out which one you're on. It goes, apply this test. Look outside. If you can't find outside, you're in a tunnel, which means you're being ripped off. Yeah, he says the I-215 tunnel adds about $10 to your fare, but one in three cabbies long-hauled undercover cops through it anyways. And so so essentially there's this concept in cab driving that's called a long-hauled, where there is a way to get to A to B, point A to point B efficiently, and you don't take that route.
Right.
You go a longer way, increases your fare, essentially. And so they're saying that they've proven that these guys do this and it adds about $10 to your fare because they do it. I honestly do not know if my cabbie did that or not, because I didn't care. HP was paying for the whole thing. So I love this. He says, the country hasn't seen this kind of bizarreness since Baker T. Robertson opened a ski mask hut outside of Wells Fargo in 1979. Like, awesome.
That's funny.
So anyways, he said, you know, what can be done about this? You know, and so he says, so Uber had a naive solution. Uber's absurd answer to long hauling is straight from your childhood. When a driver behaves badly, he only gets one star. Within hours, Uber adjusts your fare. Their system can do this automatically because they have everything they need to calculate an ideal fare. They have the start point, the end point, traffic conditions, and past fares. So essentially, they can set up an actuary and see, was this person charging you the right amount? And they know to look if you give them a bad rating. If that driver keeps scamming others, he automatically gets fired.
All right.
But Nevada officials found fault in Uber's stars. In fact, they kicked the company out of town for not protecting tourists. Ah. Right. So, I love this. He goes, I stand with Nevada and say, leave this to the pros. So here's the alternative 5-point plan that Nevada, like, actually did to try to stop the illegal long-hauling rides, okay?
Okay.
Plan A, people with guns, okay?
What?
They literally started up a roadside checkpoint where uniformed cops would stop occupied cabs at random and offered to persecute drivers who were taking inefficient routes.
Wow.
So in other words, welcome to Las Vegas. We are slowing you down to make sure your driver isn't slowing you down.
Right?
I love this part too, though. He goes, unfortunately, though, through no fault of the state, it didn't work. It turns out that Uber lazy tourists were too apathetic to show up in Clark County District Court during their Vegas vacation. So what they find is that only 3 of the 80 passengers actually showed up to persecute that they were being long hauled.
Wow. Like, yeah, obviously.
They were not willing to persecute over a couple of dollars. They just wanted to get to their hotels.
Yeah, yes. Seriously. That's the whole goal, right? You can be ripped off a little, you can't be ripped off. Jeez.
I love it. Next plan. Plan B. Big physical signs. Okay, he uses a different term in there, and so if you read it, be warned. Okay.
Okay.
He calls them
clean podcast.
He calls them BAPS. So big physical signs. There's another letter in there. You can figure it out. Okay. Anyways, they constructed these big signs throughout the McCarran International Airport. I love it. He has a picture of it. It's just crazy. He goes, each sign lays out state law and enumerates the proper taxi fares for every conceivable trip a tourist might take, using approximately twice as many words as it took Ronald Reagan to tear down the Berlin Wall. I love it. And so he's like, he has this picture of literally it's a huge sign It says taxi cab rider information program approximate taxi fares, and it literally is a table that has like from the airport to this destination. Here's how much you should expect to pay.
All right.
I cannot read this table from where he took the picture because it's in that small a font. So you have to walk up to this. Yeah. So, I love this part. He goes, now, how much time would it take you to hang foam boards? 5 years? 10? Well, that's why you're a middle seat guy. The Nevada Taxi Cab Authority implemented the sign program airport wide in only 2 years. Oh, I love it. The reason why is they had to haggle with the taxi industry on what the signs should say. And, yeah, kind of fun. All right, plan C. They made a big spreadsheet, okay? He said three-dimensional solutions clearly weren't cutting it. As the kids would say, Nevada had to, quote, go cyber. All right. He goes, now I need to warn you, I'm a Stanford-educated computer scientist, but you probably won't be able to follow this. So here's what Nevada did. They created a real big spreadsheet of real bad cab drivers. Then Nevada uploaded that spreadsheet to its website and said, this database is provided as a resource to assist taxi companies when evaluating potential new hires to support their goals of employing a workforce in an industry truly dedicated to the public through honesty and integrity.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. It says the Taxi Cab Authority also has a loose tooth that it has placed under its pillow to cover next year's operating budget. He goes, but unbelievably, the spreadsheet didn't do the trick either. Long hauling was worse than ever. So, plan D, the PDF. Okay, you're going to love this. Government has never met a problem that it could not solve with PDF. Sun Tzu, The Art of War, says, appear weak when you are strong, and strong when you are weak, and upgrade Adobe Acrobat. So here was... you know, Nevada thought Uber had a really complicated process because what you'd have to do is you have to activate your mobile device screen. Then you have to dry the finger or fingers to be used during the operation. Then you'd have to position your finger over the pertinent screen coordinates. You'd have to apply pressure using the pre-designated digit and then lift your finger. But Nevada's system is easy as 1, 2, 3 with no conditions on limb wetness. Number one, print out the long route voluntary witness statement. Number two, complete the sworn affidavit in view of a public notary. Number three, mail or fax the form to the Department of Business and Industry. Now, given that, here are a few insider tips and tricks to keep in mind when you're cabbing in Las Vegas. Number one, wear a fanny pack containing a desktop computer, a printer, envelopes, stamps, a fax machine, a notary, and food pellets for your notary. Number two, while in the cab, note the driver's full name, permit number, cab company name, cab number, license plate number, and physical appearance. If you don't have this information memorized for some reason, just ask the driver while you're locked in the car with him. If he wants to know why you need it, explain that you're trying to have him fired and ask for a selfie to fulfill the physical description requirement. Don't forget to bring along $10 to pay the notary to witness you sign your complaint that you were overcharged by $10. And by the way, if you need transportation to a notary, consider taking a taxi cab.
Yeah.
Yeah, he actually says he tried it and never heard anything back from them. He goes, but this is no doubt
due to the
shameful unreliability of the U.S. postal system. Finally, plan E, I kid you not, is the custom-built hardware that does one very niche thing that your phone already does on its lunch break. So some challenges cannot be met by man or software alone. The long taxi route is one of those problems. Suborbital flight is another, as we have discussed earlier. So, bites and sweets can take us far, but for the world's hardest problem, or sorry, yeah, bites and sweets. Sweats? Bites and sweats, I think that says. Anyways, so the Nevada Taxi Cab Authority voted on Tuesday to convene a committee among industry members to draw up guidelines on how to conduct a pilot test of ride integrity. That's one word squished together, or two words squished to make one. It's a software and hardware package designed to let the Authority track cab movements and trip details online. A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single commission voting to convene a committee to draw up guidelines. So Nevada estimates that it'll cost approximately $6 million per year to install, operate, and oversee these new ride integrity machines inside every cab in the city. You'll pay for all of this through an increase in your taxi fares. Yes.
You know, and I just...
I love technology because it beats things like this. Amazing. You know, it's amazing. You know, Uber's kind of, they do some shady things. Don't get me wrong. There's something going on with their corporate culture that I have massive issues with. I'll get there. But man, technology could, I mean, like, before smartphones, like, that's a legit solution, you know? We're going to install these special software and devices to track cabs and make sure that they're all being honest and fair. I mean, the ironic part was back then they had a monopoly and there was no choice, so there's no point in tracking and trying to make sure that they're fair because we're all stuck with them, you know? And now all of a sudden there's competition and the unfairness of the situation becomes very realistic. But it's just crazy, like,
the monopolistic abuse.
The technology, A, enabled competition, and B, took something that would cost $6 million per year and is, like, it's so much less than that. It's crazy.
Yeah, made it a couple.
It's something that can do on its lunch break. It does in the background.
Lines of code. But the problem is that the head of the commission, whose brother happens to build dedicated hardware for tracking taxi cab companies, isn't going to get the contract for $6 million if he doesn't, if they use cell phones. I don't know. I mean, we go so far out of our way to not talk politics on this show. But the only thing that I have to ask, and I'll ask this one question, is who benefits from all of this? Who's the one group that benefits from all of this? It's the taxi cab companies. And where is the money flowing from? Where is the money flowing to? It's the taxi cab companies. And obviously they have the most to gain and the most to lose from competition, so they'll use whatever thing they can in a state that's not unfamiliar with mobs taking major business investors and to get the job done that they need done. You know, and I don't know. It's so frustrating because it's basically a company like Uber, like you said, you know, they're not beyond criticism at all, but there are other companies that don't require criticism that are trying to compete with Uber that are, you know, that are being pushed out for the same reason, and they can't win their way in. But it's because of just a unholy mob-like relationship between them, and it's so frustrating. It's so frustrating. It just is you're not legally, we're not going to, and like you said, and the most important part about all of this is what you said first, those police checkpoints. They put armed people who are legally allowed to kill you if you disobey any infraction. I mean, and that's the important thing. Like, that's how the law system works. If you don't obey if you break some law, no matter how insignificant and unimportant, and they try to arrest you and detain you, and you say, no, that's really stupid, they have the right to kill you. Anytime you break the law, if you do not completely oblige, they've got the power to kill you. And we give them that right. And, like, it's insane that's how... my gosh, I can't believe that Nevada lets that happen. The citizens of Nevada don't just uprise and go, this is ridiculous. But, you know, hey, man. Rent seeking.
I think they are.
It's a lot of people.
Well, and I think people are just going, whatever, I'll be illegal. No big deal.
Well, yeah, and most importantly, yeah. it's the well, yeah, they're selling unpackaged cigarettes out in front of a convenience store, loose cigarettes is the term, it's you know what, I think I crossed the line there too far into politics, so I'm gonna stop.
All right, cool. Anyways, I thought it was a fantastically written article. And I think it just makes the case for technology and why it's great. That's why I liked it.
Yeah. I like it too.
Yeah.
It's definitely very interesting. So
yeah, we should probably pick up the pace ever so slightly here.
Right, because there's quite a few of these. So Google Glass is not dead.
Yeah, it is.
Boom. I know, right? That's kind of what I thought. But Google just announced that they're teaming up with Intel for the next generation of Google Glasses. And they're using Intel chips instead of whatever they're using right now. Texas Instruments, TI stuff. I just thought it was interesting that they're sticking with the next generation of hardware. I thought it was worth mentioning.
I think that's the interesting part, right? Who cares about the chips? Any different functionality? Any better design? Any price decrease?
Any reason to buy it?
Yeah. No, not yet. Okay, cool.
Yeah. But they're sticking with it. That's what I wanted to mention.
Well, no surprise. I said I was going to have a ton of money. Lucky them. Also, speaking of Google, did you know that they've sold more Chromebooks to U.S. schools than Apple did for iPads in the last quarter?
I'm not surprised. I did not know that, but I'm not surprised either.
Yeah, I mean, it's close, right? Google shipped 715 Chromebooks, whereas Apple shipped 702,000.
Well, okay. Chromebooks.
Now, what's interesting, though, Chromebooks start at $199, whereas iPad Airs are $370. Yeah, iPad Airs are $379.
I was going to say.
Apple's still making a lot more money, but that's why they're more popular, is because of price.
Okay. I was going to say, that was going to be my guess. The average price of a Chromebook is probably less than the starting price of an iPad, which makes it all the more impressive that.
You're breaking up pretty bad. Can you let's put our qualities down?
Is that better?
Maybe. Hopefully.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Cool.
Yeah, I was just one of the other things they found, which is kind of fun. I get it from an IT perspective. It probably kills me as a teacher. Turns out that iPads are easier to hack than Chromebooks because you can do more with them. And so, you know, like with a Chromebook, it's just the internet. And so, you know, they're able to secure them better. Whereas with an iPad, like, you have apps and all sorts of other stuff, and kids are learning how to get around all the restrictions and hack them to do what they want. Which, again, from an IT perspective, okay, I get it. From a parental creativity perspective, I'm like, nah, give them an iPad.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it's pretty funny. I'm just like, oh, yeah, that's... Oh, well. Yeah. So, yeah, but Chromebooks, man, apparently they're still rocking. I did not give them a lot of credence, and you know, but again, Google's got an infinite amount of money, so they'll keep doing it and keep improving it, you know, which I think is good. I think it's genuinely good. I would still not buy a Chromebook today if it were up to me, but... you know, that's the fun part about this, right? They're not selling to the actual users, so it's okay.
Yeah, I think there's a legitimate use case. I don't think it's huge, and I think a lot of people buy it and are disappointed by it because it's cheap and it costs too much for what they get. But that's just my opinion. It's like my opinion, man. So this was really interesting. The FCC has alleged that Netflix is effectively working to secure an internet fast lane. So there's a buffering tool that Netflix uses that is proprietary. It's their own dealio. They do it, they use it, they build it, and they don't tell anybody else about it. They don't license it. There are other buffering technologies out there that that are open source that do not take off because and buffering on the routers and stuff, and it effectively allows it to run around the networks. They're, you know, the buffering, how they kind of like do the balancing and buffering, it allows data packages to transmit quickly from source to client, from the server to the user, to the person that's been watching the video. Their own stuff on everybody, and they're not allowing the open source, open community standards to take off. And since they're the only ones that can use it, nobody else is able to access this cool buffer technology. And so having to go the slow way around. And the FCC is alleging that basically all of this, you know, Netflix has been complaining about getting Prime and AT&T and all of its competitors. Then Netflix goes and does this. And it's actually an interesting argument because it does have, like, it's a weird, it's a gray area as far as I can tell of, you know, yeah, you should be able to use, you know, the best technology should win, and they've got the best technology, but because it's actually affecting how the network, you know, how the networks actually carry information around, it does allow them to get this almost unfair advantage. And this is, you know, when you talk about government regulation and Netflix, or not Netflix, but net neutrality is wrought with that. You know, they talk about the whole Title II, is that what it is? Where they turn them into a,
Sure.
But it's, you know, if you give the government the ability to regulate these networks, this is the sort of thing that they might step into and start to regulate, if they become common carriers. And say, no, you can't do that. I don't care if it's better technology. I don't care if it allows Netflix mm-hmm. to stream their stuff faster. They can't use it because not everybody can use it. And maybe that's good. Maybe that's what I should be rooting for. But at the same time, because, you know, allowing everybody to compete on an equal foot means that Netflix won't become a monopoly. But at the same time, if Netflix has legitimately the best technology, then I get a worse experience because the government has regulated this out of existence. It's an interesting.
Well, I mean, Netflix has zero motivation to try to improve it in the future.
Yes, exactly.
You may not notice it, right? 10 years from now, you go, "Wow, why are we still running the same stuff?"
Right, and I when we talk about this kind of thing, it's always worth noting the extra complication, and I think it's interesting that the FCC has come out and added, you know, they've made a public statement about this to sort of say, look, it's complicated, you know, it's not as easy as Verizon and Comcast and not Verizon, Comcast and Time Warner and all those guys are evil and they're terrible and shouldn't be allowed to do what they're doing. It's more complicated than that. And effectively Netflix is just from a different direction. And I don't know. It's worth thinking about.
That is worth thinking about. You know, it's also worth thinking about.
You agree. What?
Snapchat geofilters.
Is it worth thinking about?
So here's what I'll describe the feature real quick. And then I have a bigger thought. So Snapchat's got a new thing. You can set up a photo and essentially set up a geofilter fence or a geofence where it's like, if someone comes within this, then, oh my gosh, I just saw a side headline that said classic adventure game Day of the Tentacle is coming to PS4 and PS Vita. What?
Oh, baby.
Man, dude, you're downloading that, right? I mean, that's like a
I'll play it for you.
Oh, please do. If you could stream it, I would watch it, for the record. Just putting it out there.
Yeah, they're actually streaming this entire keynote via Twitch. I thought that was an interesting decision.
Dang, interesting. No, I'm just saying, dude, if you did that, I would watch you play. I'm just saying.
That's awesome. I love that.
I have, anyways, so, which is like almost more exciting than Snapchat's thing. So the idea is you take a snap, you add a geofilter, if someone goes within it, they get a notification saying that you got a snap, they can look at it. Okay? Here's what I don't understand. So that's the feature. It's one of those where I'm like, from an event or from a corporate standpoint, dude, that's kind of awesome. You know, I wish you could set it up so that it wasn't clear if it's like for everyone who comes within and has the app, because that would be so much better as opposed to just your friends.
Right.
You know, which still has utility, but limited. But could you imagine, like, yeah, could you imagine, you know, if I owned, and sometimes I want to own like a coffee shop or small business, a storefront, yeah, so that I can like do a bunch of these things from a business standpoint, because it's like, oh, I could use Square. You know what I mean? Because it's just like, oh, yeah, do work. But I think about things like this, where it's like, you know, iBeacons, I would use it because I could. And, you know, and try this to see how this actually works. And because from a business standpoint, dude, this would be like amazing to set up. But I think it's interesting, you know, and maybe this is more a comment on Snap Cash, which is probably more related to Square than Snapchat itself. But like, why is it, how do I want to, I had this thought earlier this morning. Let's see if I can articulate it properly. There are certain companies who we dislike, but yet they still seem to be successful. Snapchat is a great example of that. I think in some ways Facebook falls into that category, you know, where it's like from a company leadership standpoint, you're not crazy about them, but, you know, they seem to be successful. And it's one of those where you sit there and it's like, it's almost like they're successful despite their leadership. The product is just that good that it is able to overcome dumb leaders, which is kind of like usually investors will say we care about the people more than the product. But I think there are certain products there that's just not true. The product is that good, it doesn't matter.
I've said it a bunch of times with Snapchat. It was a brilliant idea brought to you by really annoying people.
I think like, there's a part of me that goes, was that attitude required to make it what it is? Or had it been under someone who was still brilliant in the same ways, but not an idiot, you know, actually had like some moral integrity, you know, what would this product have become? You know, would it have blown up to be even bigger than what we think it is? You know, I don't know. I think about Google and, you know, Larry and Sergey, they seem like pretty legit guys. You know, they strike me as people with a strong moral compass. I mean, clearly smarter than either of us combined. I guess their combination, let's be clear. but they also seem like guys who, like, they genuinely want to try to do the right things. You know, the whole don't be evil motto, and we could argue whether or not they've stumbled, and that's, you know, they have, and that's because they're, shocker, human, and not the ones who are always running the show. But I think they're an example of a company that is like, could Snapchat have been like a Google-esque type of thing where it blows up huge because you were willing to do the right things the right way? And, you know, instead, yeah, it's a success despite the fact that they did the right things the wrong way. And I don't know. I just had that thought because I've continued to dislike Snapchat. And I look at this stuff they're offering another feature that's going to enable them to be just that much more successful, and they're not going to die, and that bugs me.
You know what? I think I do think they managed to pass a tipping point where they've now got a really,
they
really
reached the launch velocity, or what is it called?
The escape velocity.
Escape velocity.
They might have.
Man, don't tell me that stuff.
But it's from a personnel perspective. Now, I think the leader, the main leader, I can't remember his name. He is a more minor and minor character in the overall running of the company, and as a result, you're seeing him. More and more you're seeing him just take that's a fair. Further yeah and as a result you're getting these really, really great it's like the app is just so much more stable than it ever has been, and that's because the original app team isn't building it anymore, because it's, you know, it's actually they've hired a team of really great engineers finally, and I'm glad
that leads into my next article, actually.
Go for it.
Oh, it's not actually highlighted, but I'm going to mention it anyways because you put it up there. You teed it up perfectly.
Okay.
And it was how to hire when everyone wants to found their own company or their own startup.
Yeah.
And it was this interesting thing that it was talking about where startups go through these cycles. And they give an example of PayPal, where what they actually call themselves the PayPal Mafia. And it just so happened that PayPal had a bunch of these founding developers, okay, who were working on PayPal. And then it turned out that two of them started Yelp, one of them started Yammer, another one started LinkedIn, three of them helped start YouTube, one of them started 500 Startups, one of them started Clarum, one of them founded Slide, one of them was a co-founder in Tesla, you may know him, and then one of them is a partner in Sequoia Capital. Those guys were all involved with PayPal.
Yeah.
And they just sat there and went, you know, you're like, how in the world did PayPal do that? And what they were saying was really interesting is these things go through cycles where when times are good and money's flowing like crazy, like it's how do I want to explain it? So you get something like PayPal, right, where they got a whole bunch of talent together. And they built something amazing, right?
Yeah.
And then because of that success, they all split, groups gone. But furthermore, new people with ideas, you know, new top talent, they go, dude, I'm going to start something up myself because I've got this opportunity to be successful.
Right.
And all of the top talent says that. Therefore, none of the – or very few of the startups actually are able to get top talent because they're all off doing their own thing. And then you have this contraction where all of a sudden startups aren't really making it big anymore, and it's kind of frustrating. And so then the next round of top talent's like, well, I'm going to go work for someone that's successful already because that's a little safer because it appears like this whole startup thing isn't working. And so then all of a sudden startups are able to group talent together. They do something amazing, and it blows up, and everyone goes, all right, I want to go start my own thing, and it breaks up again. But it was just this interesting idea of like, the startup world in terms of talent goes through these booms and busts and contractions and expansions. And I have no idea where we are right now. I feel like we're in an expansion period.
My personal experience would say you are absolutely right.
Yeah. And so
I would say we are coming towards the end of the expansion period. It is impossible to find good talent that will stay focused on one project. Like just
in. Yeah. Yeah. See, there's that issue. And cause it all just gets spread too thin cause there's, you know, this feeling of other opportunity that's out there. And so it's very interesting. So when you say like, you know, Snapchat, they finally got some good developers to help out. It's kind of like, that's impressive. You know, because they must be doing well, and yeah, I don't know. I thought it was good. Anyways,
it was interesting. Interesting
article. Definitely. Anyways, go ahead.
All right, So NASA sent a rocket to Mars. Or no, they didn't, but they're going to. They're going to send people, and they launched a rocket ship. That's the first step towards that.
About time.
I know. But we're kind of running out of time, so I'm going to skip right down to this one. How old were you in 1994? 11?
11.
So I was like 7. So there was something interesting because I've looking back, we've always looked at ourselves as Nintendo guys, right? And one of the big deals for me buying the PlayStation 4 was this was the first non-Nintendo video game system I ever bought. And it felt weird buying a PlayStation. I still feel weird thinking, oh, I'm a PlayStation guy. Like, it doesn't feel right. And I've never really understood, like, never really been able to wrap my head around why that is. And then I read an article that totally explained it for me. And it's called Level Up, How PlayStation Infiltrated Youth Culture. And basically this idea of Sony decided to develop this video game system. And they called it the PlayStation, and they were coming into a market that was dominated by the Nintendo Super Nintendo Entertainment System, the SNES, and the Sega. Launched in Japan on the 3rd of December 1994, the PlayStation revolutionized the games the video games industry. At the time, veteran manufacturers like Nintendo and Sega fought over the family and male teen market with consoles that looked like the consoles had always looked, and the games that played like games had always played. With its advanced 32-bit processor and accelerated graphics hardware, the PlayStation was designed specifically to generate real-time 3D visuals, moving away from painted backgrounds of the previous generations. The look and language of game design changed forever. I've kind of been on a kick. I can't remember if I mentioned it last week. Did I mention the history of video game graphics?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that was a great video that just kind of like brings you all along, and this kind of fits into that ecosystem of what happened with the PlayStation, why did it work? So one of the big arguments is it's better technology. As you said earlier, it doesn't matter what you do in your campaign. If you get the new technology home and it doesn't work right, you're not going to talk about it. And the most important thing to do is to get word of mouth going. That's one of your most powerful, the most powerful form of advertising. So obviously Sony, the PlayStation did what it did partly because it was a great piece of hardware, but they were having a hard time generating excitement. In a market that was already super saturated by two other systems that were fighting over a particular demo, which was male teenagers. So they talked about one of the first marketing guys working for Sony Computer Entertainment in England, in Britain. And he said, I saw how the underground club scene was influencing the youth market. So what he saw was that there was these trends, these cultural trends that were coming out of your 20 to 28 year olds in the fashion, music, all that sort of stuff, and it was filtering down to the younger generations, like it always has forever. And so what he decided to do was to try to pump up the video game system in that market. And what he would do is he was into the Britain underground music, and so he would go and he would pay these clubs and different dance scenes to basically say, hey, set up a room in your back like a lounge, and we're going to set up one of the coolest entertainment visual graphics things in the world and just let people chill back there and play. And he said it was really hard because, like, for him, one of the things he talked about was that they had this because of how they do marketing campaigns, all marketing campaigns were these giant TV marketing campaigns. And he basically said it's not going to work for this system in this environment. We got to do something different. Marketing campaigns have the downside of being planned out over a very long period of time. All the money's already set aside. So he basically had to hide £100,000 of the marketing budget in a slush fund. Nice. So that he could go around and get involved in these different events that were going on. And he said, because the problem was basically he'd get a call from a promoter like 2 days before the event saying, hey, we want to give so I used to rough cut the budget. I'd hide at least £100,000 a year in a slush fund, which allowed me to react very quickly. Somebody would phone up on Thursday saying, we've got a little snowboard event on Saturday. Can you help? So I'd say, yes, I'll bring you 500 quid or a grand or some prizes. Basically show up and be able to advertise with it. And just sort of like really penetrate that market. And of the older people. And it's funny, one of them said, famously, the company produced a cardboard flyer for the 1996 Glastonbury Festival featuring a PlayStation logo and the words, more powerful than God. The card was serrated into small sections, coincidentally perfect to provide filters or roaches for joints. It was the phrase that ended up causing. So basically just getting, just knew what would get popular amongst that age group and did those things to get them all excited and, tied PlayStation. Did an entire marketing campaign based on that. Sony finally recognized its need to be in the UK. The UK was a very minor market up to that point, and so they finally got on the bandwagon and really started – focusing on that market, which allowed them to get a good stronghold there, which in turn allowed them to sort of move over to in America eventually. But the big, and I thought this was the most interesting part in this entire article, was the PlayStation took the average age of the gamer from 14 to 23, and basically basically made it more popular with the older crowd, because at that point it was nerdy, dorky kids that were playing video games all the time. And in one major campaign, it didn't, you know, we always think of, oh, I grew up with video games. Video games are popular now, or I've often thought of this. Video games are popular for adults now because we grew up with video games, and there's a tremendous amount of truth to that. But it was a dedicated marketing campaign that made it okay, because if that hadn't been the case, then by the time we got to the point where we were 15, 16, and we were kind of out of the age group, less and less kids would have been playing video games. They had to make it compelling for, quote, older people to be playing it. And they did. And that was the whole point, was getting the clubbers, getting the partiers to get on board with it. And which I think is really interesting. But I also think it's really interesting that that's why I wasn't into the PlayStation. That's the bad taste that it left in my mouth, is that it was completely, when we were kids and it was being marketed around us, it was being marketed to people way older than us. And it was just stuff that, as kids being protected by our parents, you know, they were fine with us playing.
Thanks, Mom and Dad, by the way.
Right. it was cool to play Super Mario Bros. Cause that was cartoonish and fun. The older kids stuff, we were being told, no, you can't play that kind of stuff, you know, and that's adult content. And they were probably right. Cause that was the whole point, was to try to get it to be adult content, to attract adults. And I don't know. I just thought it was when Grand Theft Auto started to come out and stuff like that, where it's like, you know, it basically allowed them to push that forward, and that's how they got into the market, and that's how they beat down, you know, Sega did a couple of things to itself to just crush itself, but that's really where Sony came in. That's the reason why we got a Nintendo 64 and not a PlayStation, and that's the reason why, you know, it's not until I've gotten kind of to an older age that, oh, I do want a PlayStation, and I'm okay with that. And I don't know. I just, man, I was so young. I was entirely unaware of what was going on around me. But in retrospect, oh yeah, that totally makes sense. I thought it was really an interesting perspective on video gaming. But
yeah, no, that's I wouldn't think of that, but I could see that. Yeah, we definitely were, you know, lived sheltered lives, which is okay. I'm totally okay with it. And they weren't marketing to us, and so we weren't attracted to it. That makes sense.
And we had plenty of time to be told, you know, introduced to the world, real world, later on. That would have put me at like 8, and perfectly okay with not being the target audience for video games at that age. It's just interesting that, like, you know, that there is validity to the idea that Visa pays Mattel an unbeliever that when Barbie has a credit card, it's a Visa credit card, because they want that association. It sticks with you. It really does. It's crazy. Yeah. And I don't know. I hate being led like a sheep by marketers. And that's the other reason why this kind of stuff is important to me, because I want the best game system. I don't want to be led, because, you know, 2 decades ago I couldn't tell the difference. But anyways, so speaking of marketing, Yahoo is on track to pass Twitter as one of the biggest online advertisers. I think they'll do it next year. Yahoo. That's right. Yahoo.
They're making a comeback.
I know. Marissa Mayer. Yeah. It's just, that one dude that they fired after he was there for like...
Yeah, the liar in chief.
They lucked out. She decided that she wanted to prove. Yeah, you know what? I wonder, is she, because she was one of the, she was like one of the, your first like 25 employees at Google, right? I mean, she was
Yeah, but then something weird happened where they didn't say she got demoted, but she didn't get promoted, and someone else did ahead of her. And it was kind of like, from what I understood, she was kind of like, what? That's not fair.
Yeah.
Her job suddenly became very static, and she wanted more.
Yeah, well, but I guess my point is, I think for her own, I get the feeling that she wanted to prove that what happened, she was partially responsible for what happened at Google, that she was one of the players that she understood. And so she said, well, fine, if you won't acknowledge me at Yahoo or at Google, I'll go somewhere else and show you the Asmodeus syndrome. For those of you who are Watchmen fans, you'll get that reference. Basically, become a bag of, you know, you, okay, I'll get into it. Asmodeus, the bad guy, he has tremendous success early in life, but all of his critics say that it was because his parents gave him a lot of money when they died. And so he gave away all of his money, became a vagabond, and started over again in his mid to late, you know, in his like mid-20s, and became another tremendously successful guy on, quote, his own talents, to prove that he didn't get there on the back of somebody else. As much as you could prove that doing that anyways. So yeah, definitely. That's another one to pay attention to in 2014.
Yeah. Sounds like it. Very cool, man. Very, very cool. Tech. I love it. It's good stuff. Good stuff. Well, everybody, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for listening. We really do appreciate it. Don't forget to check out the show notes at forlibros.com for all the different links, because it'll all be there. With that, I am James Furlow. My mustache handlebar brother is Matthew Furlow. Oh my gosh, I don't have the music even kind of ready to go.
That's all right. We'll just fill. We're pretty good at that.
I'm fast. I got it. I'm ready to go. Yeah. So on that note, everybody, we will talk next time. Thank you.